Welcome to Eucharist Church. .ca.
If you've been with us the last couple of weeks, you know that through Advent, we've been looking at various songs, carols that we sing at Christmas time and sort of considering what they tell us about the Christmas story. And today, we're considering O Holy Night. And I think that the history of the song speaks to, in some ways, to its message. So I'm going to take us through it a little bit. It starts in 1847 in this little town in France where one of the French priests wanted a poem for Christmas Eve. And so he asked a local poet, whose name was Placide Capot, if he would write a poem for him. Now, Placide was a good poet, but he was also the commissioner of wines and not a particularly reliable guy. He wasn't a churchgoer. Ultimately, he joined the Socialist Party and left the church entirely, but he wrote a poem. And he liked the poem so much that he asked his friend, Adolf Adams, to put it to song. And Adams was a really good composer, and he wrote for lots of ballets and orchestras across the world and was very well known. But he was also a Jew, and so he didn't understand anything about the words of the song, and he didn't understand anything behind Christmas, but in any event, he wrote the song. And so on Christmas Eve, for the first time, the French song, which was then called the Canticle de Noël, was sung in France. But shortly after that, somebody in the French Catholic Church sort of investigated the song and decided that it wasn't from very good origins, and so they banned it and said that they couldn't sing it anymore, that it lacked, what did it say? I liked this. Because of its lack of musical taste and total absence of the spirit of religion. But the song was very popular, so the common folk in France continued to sing it. And then shortly after, it became noticed by this writer whose name was John Sullivan Dwight. And Dwight was a pastor and a graduate of the Harvard Divinity School. But he was a pastor, but he had mental health struggles. He was agoraphobic, and he was afraid to leave his home. And he had panic attacks, and he often would have a panic attack while he was preaching, which I personally can relate to right this minute. But so he had to step down from the pulpit and find something else to do. So he started a music magazine where he found songs, and he published them in his magazine. And he found this song, and he was mesmerized by the lyrics. He loved how it told the story of Christmas, and he especially liked how it talked about the breaking of chains and the freeing of slaves, because this was right before the Civil War, and John Sullivan Dwight was an abolitionist. So this broken man who published a magazine because he had to step down from being a pastor took this song written by two outsiders, a song that had been cast out by the church, and he took this song that talks about hope for the broken and freedom for the oppressed, and he translated it into English and introduced it into America. And then finally, on Christmas Eve in 1906, this is the last piece of the history of this song, a 33-year-old professor named Reginald Fessenden was playing with a new type of generator, and he had been working with Thomas Edison on radio waves. And he spoke into the microphone that night, and for the first time in the history, a human voice would broadcast over the airways. And he read, and it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. So the first words ever broadcast over radio were Luke 2, the story of Jesus. And after he finished reading, he picked up his violin and played O Holy Night, making it the first song ever sent through the radio airwaves. That story behind O Holy Night is a story of outsiders, outcasts, and broken people. But that's also the story of Christmas. I can't read it, but it's fine. That's also the story of Jesus. Think about Mary and Joseph. Remember that Mary got pregnant before she was married, and we know she's a virgin, but that's after the fact. As far as anybody else knew, she was just an unwed teenage mother. And then think about Mary and Joseph, why they had to go to Bethlehem in the first place. They were oppressed. They were under the thumb of the Roman Empire. The emperor had demanded that everybody go back to their birthplace to be registered to pay taxes. So Joseph puts Mary on the back of a donkey, and they travel 80 miles across the desert, living outdoors, sleeping on the ground. It takes over a week, and Mary is 9 months pregnant. When they get to Bethlehem, nobody will take them in. Mary and Joseph were oppressed. And then you have the shepherds. Shepherds were outcasts. Polite society looked down on shepherds. They were dirty and smelly. They were suspected of being thieves and robbers, and they probably were. They weren't even allowed to give testimony in the court of law because nobody trusted them. Shepherds were outcasts. And then you have the wise men, or the real term is magi. The magi were magicians from the royal courts of Persia. They were outsiders. They were strangers. They had strange beliefs and strange customs. They practiced astrology, which was a big no-no for the people of Israel. And yet, there they were, strange customs and all. The magi were strangers. So who's at the manger? The oppressed, the outcast, the outsider, the poor, the hurting, people who are broken. And maybe that's you. Maybe you feel oppressed today by problems, depression, anxiety, an illness. Maybe you've lost your job and you're dreading Christmas because you don't have the resources to celebrate it the way you want to. Maybe you've lost someone this year and you're dreading Christmas because it's just going to be painful. Maybe you feel like an outcast because a relationship you're in is failing. Your partner doesn't love you anymore. Your boyfriend or girlfriend broke up with you. A good friend won't give you the time of day. Maybe you feel like an outsider because everybody else is looking forward to time with family and you don't have family, or your family are so dysfunctional that you can't stand being with them. Oppressed, cast out, an outsider. Maybe that's how you feel today, and you're hurting and you're broken. Paul knew about this, and in the Bible, this is what he says to one of his churches. Brothers and sisters, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. God chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one can boast before him. God's funny that way. God chooses the foolish to shame the wise. He chooses the weak to shame the strong. He reaches out to the lonely and the hurting, the sick and the poor, the oppressed, the outcasts, the outsiders. And what's more, he takes those people, us, and uses them, us, in ways that we could never imagine. Never underestimate what God can do with the maybe meager skills you think you bring. I remember being amazed when this job at Eucharist came up for me, that one of the most important skills that I brought with me were skills that I had developed at a time in my life where I had pushed God away. And I wasn't even listening to him. And yet he knew what was ahead in a way that I didn't. And he was developing things in me that were ultimately going to be important, even though I didn't recognize that. God took an unlikely bunch, and we have this beautiful song. He took an unlikely bunch and gave us his presence on earth. What do you think he might do with our unlikely bunch? This is a beautiful song with so many ideas that we could unpack about Christmas, but I'm going to focus just on a couple of the phrases from the song that stuck out to me. The first line is, "Long lay the world in sin and error pining, till he appeared and the soul felt its worth. The song says pining. Pining is such a great word. There's so many great words in this song. Pining means to yearn deeply, to suffer with longing, to long painfully, to fall gradually in health or vitality from grief, regret, or longing. And I think sometimes when we look at the world around us, even the earth itself feels like it's pining these days, like it's just asking for rebirth. And that soul, the phrase is, the soul felt its worth. Now, my guess is that you have some response to that idea of the soul feels its worth. And it's either, thank you, Lord, or it may be, some people have worth, but not me. And I fluctuate between those two ideas. And one of the things that I know, it's pretty clear that as humanity, we struggle with this idea of worth. And as I was thinking about it, I think there's really two main roadblocks that we have in understanding our worth. The first is this idea of a faulty narrative. We all have these tapes that play in our heads. You have things that people have said to you that make you define who you are, that just play in over and over in your head. It could be something your mom or dad said to you when you were a kid, or a sports coach, or a teacher, somebody who said, you're never going to amount to anything, or you're stupid, or you're ugly. And we all have these narratives that we carry with us that plays in your head. It's something you've been told, and we believe it on a heart level. Even if at a head level we say, no, I know that's not true, on a heart level, it's the background music to everything we do. So we find ourselves trying to pretzel into something that will show that there's worth. The second thing I think, if you've been raised in the church, might be faulty theology. Sometimes our view of God suggests to us that people don't have worth. It's this blurring of the difference between having worth and being worthy. So the Bible's really clear. It says, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. It says, none is righteous. No, not one. So we are unworthy. Worthy means deserving. And we are undeserving. But worthy is not the same thing as worth. The Bible tells us that we are not worthy, that we've fallen short of God's ideal, that we're not deserving, but the other side of the coin is that God declares clearly and unequivocally that humanity has worth, deep, abiding worth. What happens theologically is sometimes we tie those two things together. We say that being worthy is the same thing as having worth. We're not worthy, so we don't have worth. But I want to tell you that that is a lie. And Satan would love, love, love to keep you bound in thinking that you have no worth because you are not worthy. The message of the gospel is the message that although we are unworthy, the God of the universe sees you as having unending value and worth. And he proves it in this season of Christmas when we celebrate him coming to us, entering our story, living and dying and taking our sin on himself and conquering death through the resurrection. You cannot read the Christmas story and not come to the conclusion that in the eyes of God, humanity has deep, deep worth and value. Instead of sitting in, I'm unworthy, maybe we can change the narrative and ask God, tell me who I am in your eyes. Listen to the way John, one of the writers in the Bible, talks about the coming of the Messiah. He says, the true light, which gives light to everyone, was coming into the world. And to all who received him, who believed in his name, he gave them the right to become children of God. We are light. We are children of God. That's who you are. And God says, I'm not just leaving you on your own. I'm coming to live in the middle of it. So what if this Christmas we allowed ourselves to hear the voice of God singing over us and speaking worth into our souls? What if this Christmas we heard the Christmas story not so much about a baby born in a manger in this small town, but of God speaking worth over humanity? What if your soul could feel its worth? The next line is the thrill of hope a weary world rejoices. I'm sure that the world that Jesus came into was weary. Weary of the Roman occupation, weary of religious oppression, weary of waiting for the promise of the Messiah to be fulfilled, and they'd been waiting for a long time. What makes us weary these days? Weary of sitting in mall traffic, weary of waiting in checkout lines, weary of being sick, weary of the stresses of the holidays. And I suspect that our fatigue goes even deeper. Weary of looking for the right person or the right job. Weary of worrying when life's going to be worth living. Weary of waiting to see if God really cares about you. Just weary. What Jesus promises us, the song says, is the thrill of hope. If you look up hope in the dictionary, it's defined as a desire for or an expectation of good. And implicit within the definition of hope is that you don't currently have it. Look at the way Romans unpacks hope. It says, for in this hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is no hope. And I'm going to suggest that hope is the distance between your reality and your expectation. The reason our hearts explode with the thought of Christmas is because the Christmas story answers the deepest longings of our soul. Christmas stirs up some mixed emotions for most of us. There's a distance in your life between reality and your expectation. And so that gives us a choice. We can either try to lower the gap by lowering our expectations, or we can invite God, the God who says, I'm for you and I'm with you, to speak into that gap. What Christmas reminds us is that every single hope we have, if you were to kind of dig underneath it and look at what underneath it is, every single hope is a shadow of the things we really need. We wish that God would just fulfill our every hope and our every dream, but I'm going to suggest that he doesn't answer every hope, but he can answer the hope underneath, the everything that you need. And here's the thing about hope. Hope is not just ignorance of our present circumstances. It's just confidence in our future reality. Christmas answers the question, God, do you care? God, are you for me? God, are you with me? And God says, yes, I am. So we're going to skip the middle verse, and we're going to come to the last verse of the song. And I think what makes this song different from lots of songs that we sing at Christmas is that this song has, the last verse is kind of a call to action. One of the things that stood out to John Sullivan Dwight was this line, chains shall he break. Slavery doesn't look the same as it did then, but we still live in a world where there are 27 million people enslaved. Most of them are slaves in labor or in the sex trade. The average age of these 27 million slaves is 12, and only between 1 or 2% of them will ever be rescued. So let's not kid ourselves. Slavery exists in our world in a real way. Chains shall he break. We, the people of God, need to care about those who are enslaved, who are oppressed, who are in danger, who are hurting. We cannot allow ourselves to forget or be complacent about the oppressed and enslaved in our world. But here's another thing. We're not in those numbers. And it's easy for us to push them aside and not see them as real because we don't see the faces. We don't know the stories that go along with it. But we're all in chains to something. So there's some things that you wish you could get loose from that are holding you down. Our slavery looks a little different, but it's no less true. So I want to read Luke 4, 16 to 21. This is Jesus. He went to Nazareth, where he had been brought up. And on the Sabbath day, he went to the synagogue, as was his custom. He stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. Unrolling it, he found the place where it is written, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. Then he rolled up the scroll and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. The eyes of everyone in the synagogue were fastened on him, and he began by saying to them, "Today, the scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." So Jesus is in the temple, and he's telling them that he is the chosen one. He is the Messiah. He is the one that they have been waiting for by quoting this prophecy from Isaiah 61. But what everybody in that synagogue would know when they read this, when they heard him say this line, the year of the Lord's favor, there are two things going on. And the first one is, if you go back to Isaiah 61, verse 2, the whole sentence says, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God. But Jesus doesn't read that part. He doesn't read the day of vengeance. He closes the scroll, rolls it up, and sits down. The second thing that everyone would have known is that when Jesus read to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, he would have been declaring a jubilee. So in the Old Testament, in the time of Israel, there was supposed to be every 50 years a year of jubilee when the slaves would be set free, property would be returned to the original owner, where the nation of Israel would take an entire year to sit and rest, and watch their fields produce bounty that they didn't have to work to get. No, they almost never did it because it was too hard to free slaves and do those sorts of things. But what Jesus is saying is the year of the Lord's favor has arrived. Debts are forgiven and slaves are free. And he rolled up the scroll and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. And everybody's eyes are fixed on him. He's left out the day of vengeance, which is really what Israel was hoping was going to happen to the Roman Empire. And he says, this is the day of favor. This is a day of mercy. This is a day of grace. This is a day of blessing, that God isn't angry. He's coming to redeem and to save, not destroy and punish. And he sits down and he says, today this scripture is fulfilled. Today. Not someday that Jesus comes to redeem. It's not someday that he comes to offer us freedom. The freedom of God in your life is available in the present. And typically, it's before you ever clean up your life and start to work on things. Some of us are waiting for a day somewhere off in the future where we resolve some of the things that have hurt us. We resolve some of the wrongs that we've been a part of. We forgive some people we need to forgive. And then we think, maybe then I will be free. I can walk in freedom. But Jesus says, no, that's not the way it works. The freedom that I purchase, the breaking of chains that I bring, happens today, happens right now. Eugene Peterson says, the refusal or the inability to fully experience the present, to receive into our lives by faith what is handed to us by God in the present, is a refusal to live freely. For the present is the only time in which freedom can be exercised or experienced. And so we're invited to freedom. We're free from the chains of sin and past mistakes and all the things that we hold in front of us that we think keep us from approaching God. We no longer have to be chained to fear. Romans 8 says, for you did not receive the spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you have received the spirit of adoption as sons. We no longer need to be captive to shame. Isaiah 61 says, instead of your shame, you will receive a double portion, and instead of disgrace, you will rejoice in your inheritance. And so you will inherit a double portion in your land, and everlasting joy will be yours. We all know shame. There are lots of things crummy about shame. But one thing truth about shame this afternoon that I want you to think about, I actually wrote this morning, is when I carry shame, I can't carry joy. You're going to hold on to one or the other. One or the other is going to define your life. Jesus isn't adding joy onto your shame. He's not just speaking joy into your shame. He says he's going to take away your shame and give you joy. Grace can cover your shame. It can speak into the very core of who you are, that Jesus is for you, that he loves you, that he's come to your rescue, that he values your life. He has redeemed you with his very life. The Christmas story is filled with joy. The angel said, "Fear not, for behold, I bring you good news of great joy." You can hold on to fear, you can hold on to joy, but you can't hold on to both. You can hold on to shame, or you can hold on to joy, but you can't hold on to both. So first, we have to claim our own freedom. We have to hand over our own chains. And there's something for us to do. Because freed people free people. When I was reading this week, I was looking at the life of Harriet Tubman, and you probably know her because she helped develop and run the Underground Railway in the United States, and she was a slave, and she escaped a life of slavery, and she became a freedom fighter. And she freed thousands and thousands of people because she was willing to stand up and say, "Freed people, free people." She was interviewed towards the end of her life, and what she said really stuck with me. She said, "I freed 1,000 slaves. I could have freed 1,000 more if only they knew they were slaves." Sometimes we don't know we're slaves, or we don't know what we're slaves to, or we don't want to be otherwise. We feel like we're slaved to something, but it's familiar and it's comfortable, and we don't want to let it go. Or we can choose to be free. The song says, "Truly he taught us to love one another. His law is love, and his gospel is peace." If we have been given hope by Jesus' birth, then that hope will shine in how we treat each other. Even when surrounded by hatred and violence, which they were then and we are now, we are called to treat each other with love and the peace that we have been given. We're to go beyond being respectful and polite, says the hymn. "Chains shall he break, for the slave is our brother, and in his name all oppression shall cease." We aren't called to be nice. We're called to work so that others can enjoy the same blessing as us. Blessings of freedom and justice. God's work is our work. What are we going to do to give others the thrill of hope? What are we going to do to help others break the chains of oppression, the chains of addiction, the chains of racism? What are we going to do to show others the worth of their soul this Christmas? God's love and peace is given to us so that we can give it to others. There is a weary world out there in need of hope. There are people out there in need of love and peace. They are our own friends and family who are shackled by grief and depression and loneliness, and people we don't even know who are held in bondage by oppressive systems and the power of prejudice. We have a song to sing to them, a song about hope. We have a story to tell, a story about the worth of their soul and a new and glorious morning. Amen.